The topic of the next session is the power of the unknown.
Author of The Black Swan and Fooled by Randomness, Taleb has been among the most quoted persons since the financial meltdown. He describes himself rather well, rather humbly, as someone interested in how to live in a world we don't understand very well. Early in life, Taleb got interested in how to turn lack of information, lack of understanding, and lack of knowledge into decisions. How not to be a turkey. And the difference between knowledge levels has given people Nobel Prizes and made millions for people. An MBA from Wharton and a PhD from University of Paris, Taleb is acknowledged as one of the experts in derivative trading and was inducted in the Derivative Strategy Hall of Fame in 2001. He is also a distinguished professor of risk engineering. Mr. Rahul Bajaj, that's one area that Indian corporate sector probably will have to look as we grow. He is a distinguished research scholar at Oxford University among a host of other academic responsibilities. He is also working with Dan Goldstein on the Ecological Uncertainty Project. And is running what he calls a family of experiments on the intuition of randomness. Ladies and gentlemen, I present to you Nassim Nicholas Taleb, the virtual god of probability.
Thank you for inviting me. I'm extremely honored to be here. I have a lot of Indian, I get a lot of mail from India, so finally I'm here to discuss things. Please, can you lower the lights? It looks like the French police interrogation where they make you say the truth, but I'm going to say, I'm going to tell you what I think, so you don't need so much. Great. So I'm a little fed up with the black swan. I'm tired of the black swan after 3 years, 3.5 years. You understand the blackbird. So I'm going to try to talk about what I've been doing since the black swan. Vastly more interesting to me, maybe not to you, but you know. But you have to promise me not to tell Penguin, my publisher, because I'm publishing 100 pages edition to the Black Swan called On Robustness and Fragility, and supposedly you're not supposed to talk about it before pub date in May. So please don't tell them. They got upset with me. I got a phone call and stuff. So I'm going to talk about that and also about some other things I've been working on as a follow-up to the Black Swan. Something I call tinkering. The book is called Tinkering, Bottom-Up Knowledge, How to Live in a World We Don't Understand. A very simple book, except that the simplicity of the title and the idea makes it very complicated to write. Usually it's the other way. So let me start now by making you feel a little uncomfortable, just a little bit, and then things will get better as we go along, okay? Do you recognize this object there? No, it's something commonly known as a wheel. No, it was discovered not far from me. I'm from Lebanon, halfway between Lebanon and here somewhere in Babylon. Okay, so it's a very good invention, no? But between, say, 4,000 and 6,500 years ago, it was discovered. Can someone explain to me why it took so long for this implementation of the wheel? It was staring at us, this thing was staring at us for 6,000 years. Okay? I'm extremely old for a trader. I'm a trader also. You didn't mention it too much. So for a trader, I'm very old. Maybe for a philosopher, I'm very young, but or not even dead, you know. But so I remember the days when I used to fly to JFK from Lebanon with suitcases, and you know, you don't want to spend the money on a porter, so you'd have to carry all these suitcases, and they have very long hallways. All it took is this contraption, the wheel. So you see how much technology is not necessarily looking, and it can stare at you for a long time. But things are actually worse. Do you recognize this object, the pyramids? The Mexican pyramids, about an hour outside Mexico City. And supposedly, the Mesoamericans did not have the wheel. They built this using slave labor. You know, you give them corn, okay, you whip them, and you make them lift stones, okay? So they did not have wheelbarrow. Is it true they did not have the wheel? Well, they did have it. They just used it on toys, children's toys. They didn't make the leap that you could, you know, make a wheelbarrow. They're rolling, you know, on stucco floors. They had stucco floors, all right, little toys, and then they had the wheels. So they didn't realize, and it would have saved them, I don't know, hundreds of millions of calories every day, okay, if they had, that simple implementation. So just to tell you how hard it is to predict which technology is going to dominate. Actually, things are going to get a little worse. And then I tell you, it will get better. Do you recognize the gentleman here? He was an actor, Californian actor, okay, who had a change of career. Suppose some say successful, some regret. Anyway, so the gentleman hated taxes, but he also hated the Soviet Union, an entity that existed in my days. I don't know if you remember. Okay, so he had this obsessive disorder with the Soviet Union that made him want to spend a lot of money trying to destroy that state, all right? So he cut taxes, he cut expenditures, but he funded DARPA. DARPA is a unit of the Pentagon that is well known now for inventing what?
Internet.
The Internet. And the Internet, thanks to which, you know, thanks to the Internet I'm here, thanks to the Internet you have Bangalore, thanks to the Internet you have Delhi, you have a lot of things, right? So, but his intention was not to help Bangalore become a big technological center. That was not on his mind. On his mind, he wanted just to destroy the Russians. That's it. That was his desire in life, his aim in life, and those other, you know, auxiliary things coming with it. So he spent all this money trying, you know, to destroy the Russians. And, of course, the first thing it did is help Russian persons with social difficulties find a spouse, okay, you know, and chat rooms. That was not his intention. So I realize why technology is very hard to predict. It's mostly dominated by these unexpected implementations that you don't see coming. And the problem is that you can't predict them, and if you cannot predict them, you can't predict history. So we are so hard to predict history if even those who invent tools don't know what to do with them. Okay. So we live in less charted rules. It's not a problem if you know it. If you don't know it, you've got a problem. All right. Which brings me to that black swan, that ugly bird. Okay. Incidentally, let me show you a picture. A lady attended one of my lectures in San Francisco, and she opened a black swan boutique. I don't know if she's still in business. She expect the unexpected, rare fragrances. All right, that's not my idea of the black swan. All right, my idea of the black swan is actually the black swan is not nothing modern. The Romans had an expression, rara avis, in other words, something as rare as a black swan. See, there's a verse by Juvenal that says a good man is as rare as a black swan. Actually, it's a good spouse, he said. I don't want to enter difficulties. Okay. And so I used the metaphor was used to something to describe near impossibility or impossibility, something like George Bush getting the Nobel Prize in physics, something like that. Okay. So that would be a black swan. I packaged my ideas using that format of the black swan by changing the story a little bit. It's not, you know, a logical problem, no matter how many white swans you've seen. It doesn't tell you anything about the possibility or impossibility of a black swan. I use it differently. I define a black swan event as an event that, unlike the bird, it doesn't have feathers. It has consequences, okay? An event of massive consequences when it happens. Low probability, like George Bush getting the Nobel Prize in physics, according to an observer. And, of course, its most vicious property is that ahead of the event is prospectively hard to predict, like the Internet, like the wheel, like all these things. But after the fact, every single person finds it obvious, and of course, they saw it coming. You can see this is why there's something called the economics profession. We have close to 1 million economists, or people who call themselves economists on the planet. Only a handful predicted the extent of what could have happened. And of course, after the fact, you have people like Joe Stiglitz or Krugman who, of course, saw it coming. Right? After the fact, it's very easy. You remember thoughts in a shower you had that vaguely related to what happened. Okay, so prospectively unpredictable, retrospectively very predictable. So, and let me now tell you the tragedy of a profession called economics, profession called finance. My problem is that we cannot see these things coming, but we know a lot about which environments are vulnerable to black swans and which environments are not vulnerable to black swans. And it has to do with build robustness. It's so obvious. A cab driver will pick up my point. The problem is once you spend too much time studying, you start losing sight of the idea. So let me show you the problem with rare events. The gentleman here, I debated him after the black swan came out. You see his picture. He was cited in a Wall Street Journal saying in summer of 2007 that events we saw in the markets, at the time it was like a prelude of 2008, but a very small prelude. He said, oh, these events should have happened every 10,000 years. And luckily, the Wall Street Journal provided very graciously his picture, or the rendition of his picture. Okay. And what strikes you there? What strikes you about both the gentleman, his picture, and the statement? Is that thanks to the Wall Street Journal, we know he's not 10,000 years old, right? He doesn't look 10,000 years old, right? So where's he getting his statement from? A theory. The rarer the event, the more you have to rely on the theory because you don't have enough observations. Very simple. The problem is that the rarer the event, the more consequences in some environments are associated with it. Say in finance, say a 100-year flood is going to be vastly more consequential than a 10-year flood. But the problem is that you don't know much about it because if you don't have 100 years of data. So you need a lot of data. The gentleman, incidentally, was employed by a firm called Lehman Brothers, if you remember. It's a firm that is no longer, where he's no longer employed. And even they did not have a track record going 10,000 years to be able to say it happens every 10,000 years. So really, these, you know, we're building all these risk management systems based on exposure to events that we deem are rare when we know nothing about them. And even if they're extremely rare as we think they are, the consequences may be a lot bigger than we think they are. Very simple. Identify which one they are and solve the problem. So my solution is as follows. Okay, a solution but helped by a long tradition of people who are ignored in history is with the following differences between mediocre stan and extremist stan. And I'm glad you guys use words that stan means state in Hindi and in Urdu, no? So I'm extremely honored to be able to finally apply this one because in Arabic, stan doesn't mean anything. So they use it. It's imported from the Hindi, all right? So mediocre stan is a province with some characteristics and extremist stan has other characteristics. And the difference between the two of them, okay, will enlighten us to where black swan opportunities and dangers are located. So let me play a thought experiment. I gather, say, 10,000 people, or say 1,000 people. Let's not make it crowded. I bring them over here, randomly selected from the world population, which means that, what, 20% of the world population is Indian, right? Okay, 20% Indian, all right? About another 20% Chinese and so on. One from New York. No more than one from Texas, please. All right. So we have a good sample of the world population. You put them on a scale, and you weigh all these people, and you add to that sample the heaviest person you can find who can still be called a person. Okay. How much of the total will he represent? See, he's 4 times the size of a regular person. Peanuts, okay? As we say in finance, 30 basis points, 0.3%. And if you move from 1,000 to 10,000, it'd be nothing. 3 basis points, okay, 0.03%. So, very simply, there are domains in which, when your sample is very large, no single observation can disrupt the total. How many of you have been in business school or studied statistics? A lot of them, and I'm sure a lot more than raise their hands because it's not good, you know, all right. So, everything you learn is based on this concept called diversification, portfolio effect, law of large numbers. it does work with weight. In other words, if you're diversified, you're broad, not a single observation is going to put a dent in the total. Okay? Does it work? Yes, it works with weight. It works with your caloric consumption. Not a single day. I eat about 800,000 calories a year. Actually, I'm lying. Maybe 1 million calories a year. Tonight there's dinner. No gala dinner. I'm going to splurge. How many calories can I consume in a single day? 3,000, 4,000, 5,000? Nothing. All right. So not a single day is going to make a difference. Now let me compare it to another province called Extremistan. Unfortunately, I can't double my weight in any given day. Unfortunately, I can't, lose 80% of my weight in a single day. I mean, 80% would be too much. 10% would be good, all right? You can't even do that in a single day, all right? Now, can you lose 80% of your wealth in a single day? Yes, very good. There you go, the difference between two domains. There's a domain in which the probabilistic structure, uncertainty, a structure of uncertainty, is extremely different from the one we study at school. And that domain, I call it Extremistan. Use the same sample of 1,000 people. Now, you, of course, same 20% Indian, we said, 20% Chinese, and so on. One from Texas, no more. Okay, so we have that sample. And add to that sample the wealthiest person on a planet who can still be called a person. Okay? How much of the total will he or she represent? 30 basis points? How much?
0.03.
Sorry?
0.03. 0.03.
So, you have the wealthiest person, he's worth $64 billion, and the rest will be worth maybe $1 million, all right? So, we're talking about, there'll be a rounding error for him. Everything will come from the exception. In Extremistan, everything comes from the exception. Everything, almost, in economic life, everything is dominated by exception. So you have to make sure that you're both protected from some classes of events and exposed to another class of events, the beneficial black swan, negative black swan. It's very simple. And you can, if we see that difference, you know a lot more than the team around President Obama, the current president. Is he still president today? Or is still around, Geithner. You know a lot more about him if you know the difference between these two. You know that where economic models, where statistical models work, they don't work. Where risk management models work, don't work. Where there's a structure of uncertainty that we know and one that we don't know. Okay? So, let me give you an idea of how economic life is dominated by the extreme. When I was a trader, I was a trader for 20 years. I was a little ashamed of it, so I don't really say it in public, but you guys are nice people, so I can say it. Anyway, so when traders get together, what do they talk about? We used to talk about art. And now I became a writer, all right? Now, when writers get together, what do they talk about? Money, all right? So I got to know a lot about the book business from the economics of the book business. I wish, I would go back to trading so I can talk about real things, all right? Anyway, so I discovered one thing. There are 1 million manuscripts in the English language, novels in the English language, in the market. A lot of these novels are, written by people who are employed by Starbucks in the United States. In the UK, it's near Cafe Nero or others. They work for pubs. In India, I don't know what the tradition for novelists, but typically they're unpublished with a novel, and they identify themselves as writers. All right. Out of these 1 million novels in the English language, about 22,000 will be published in any given year. Out of the 22,000 published, how many will represent half the sales? Sorry. Between 5 and 30, depend on whether a lady from Edinburgh is active or not active, or something like that. Okay, so you realize we have environments in economic life, thanks to globalization, is getting worse. Okay, more and more dominated by extreme. We're moving more and more into Extremistan, where most of the properties are determined by the exception. Okay, you have to identify these domains and see how exposed you are to them. So, variations, you have two classes of variations. Up top, you have Mediocristan, where you have a lot of variations, but nothing exceptionally big and no big calm periods. And at the bottom, you have Extremistan, Mediocristan, Extremistan. Which brings me to the Turkey problem. And I'll wrap up, in how many, 5 more minutes? 5, 10 minutes, and then wrap up, and then we can take questions, because the interesting things are in the questions, in the Q&A. Incidentally, there'll be maybe a low correlation between your question and my answer. because I learned when I started after on my book tour, I learned one thing. It's confusing when you listen to the question. When a journalist asks you questions, it's always confusing to listen to them. You have to think. So just answer without thinking, all right? So I started answering even without listening, and it works. All right, so I may try it. If I don't hear very well, we may just answer. So I'll always complete my presentation, all right, regardless of Q&A. No, I'm kidding. I'll listen. Anyway, so brings me to the turkey problem. My approach to the black swan. In the black swan, a turkey is fed for 1,000 days by a butcher, and every day confirms to Bernanke's group, you know, working with a turkey, that the turkey, the butcher loves turkeys with increased statistical confidence. Every day confirms that for the risk management department of the turkey, the economics department of the turkey, the Federal Reserve team of economists lent to the turkey, you know, to study its properties. Okay, every day confirms that butchers love turkeys. Comes the 1,001st day. Incidentally, 1,001 days is of Indian origin. No, not Arabic. You see how we took a lot of things from you guys, right? Anyway, so I was modeling it after 1,001 nights, right? So the 1,001st day is Thanksgiving minus 2, T minus 2. The butcher will surprise the turkey. Okay? So the turkey will have a black swan event. It's going to be a big surprise. Big surprise for the turkey. Is it a big surprise for the butcher? No. Is it a big surprise for you? No. So this whole idea is we're not to be the turkey. Simple. Okay? That's simple. All right? That's the whole idea. Visibly, the banking system, there were turkeys. This incidentally graph I gave, you know, that was before the thing. I was saying that these people make money regularly, but they're turkeys. The banking system in 1982, 1983 lost more than history of banking simply because they have a lot of hidden risk and they explode and they say, well, they're unforeseen events. But they're very fragile to these events. And of course, banks said, oh, it's exceptional. We only lost money one quarter. Of course, they lost everything they ever made. And then did it again in 91, and of course did it again now. And of course hedge funds do that, and usually they write a letter saying, dear investors, surely these events are as much of a surprise to you as they are to us. Linguistic evolution is non-existent in that business. It's the same letter that you see people rewrite every time, not knowing someone else. You know, no variations, all right? Anyway. But the problem is that, so you fool by quiet period because you use the wrong model, model for Mediocristan, for Ekremistan. If the gentleman here, during the period when the turkey is, you know, being fed by the butcher, a period when the banks are making money, peanut, pennies, sitting on barrels of dynamite, he would pronounce the events as the Great Moderation. First of all, please don't tell me I look like him. So what the gentleman did not understand is that we live in Ekremistan, and Ekremistan has these properties. Quiet, quiet, quiet. Ekremistan is mostly, what you have is droughts punctuated with floods. He thinks that you get rain, like in, you know, in New York. You get rain like every week there's a rainy day almost. That's not how it works, okay? So the problem is that he didn't see this. He thought it was a great moderation, and they don't realize that we live in a world of complexity. Let me explain complexity in a couple of minutes. You're all familiar with this object here. No?
Yeah.
Okay. This object here bankrupted a country known as Iceland. And did someone take it over today or something? No, I mean, it's still known as Iceland. Why? Because in the past, when you had a run on a bank, how did you have a run on a bank? You go wait in line, okay? You eat your breakfast, take a bus, do something, and you may change your mind. Today, how do you have a run on a bank? Twitter. Actually, he was tweeting. I was walking in, you were tweeting about this. So the whole planet withdraws from during, you know, thanks to this device you can use while driving, okay? So you realize why the world is changing. So we have a rise, for example, if you want to read the book business is the best platform. 200 years ago, few people read in the same language. People read in different languages. So you could not have the Harry Potter effect. You see, the whole planet is reading a single book. So you can't have that extreme. But the winner-take-all effect were not that exacerbated. Today, everything's exacerbated. Globalization is making it more from extremistan. A lot more from extremistan. It's simple. I mean, the whole planet, all right, depends on the same. I mean, Twitter now is used in India, right? Okay. At what time in history was something used simultaneously in different places? So the whole planet reacts as one unit. So it means that fads can be a lot more accentuated. So we have to be robust to them, and you can't control them. Governments think they can control confidence. You can't. You just have to be robust. So we have, as I said, a rise of complexity coupled with what? With a rise in fragility. Let me discuss fragility for a minute. My model is Mother Nature. You have an elephant here. I mean, you recognize you have a lot of them here.
Nathan, may I interrupt?
Sorry?
You can continue for 10, 15 minutes more. No issue about the time. So, you know, fragility and then the new book also.
Oh, okay. Okay. Thanks. The elephant, 10, 15 minutes you said?
Yeah.
And then we have Q&A.
Yeah.
All right. So, if I shot an elephant, I'd be arrested. No? Definitely. My mother would yell at me. She would call and yell at me. I know my mother, right? I'd lose some friends. Okay, we said a black foreign author shot an elephant. Would it change? Would it kill the ecosystem of elephants? No. If an elephant is the largest land animal, okay. But let's say someone shot this bank known as Lehman Brothers. What would it do to the financial? What would it have done to the financial ecosystem? Aha. We know what it does to the ecosystem. So Mother Nature built robustness to this connectivity by not having any unit too big. A very simple concept, no? Mother Nature has been doing things for a long time. That's a problem that's not well understood by economists. That human hubris comes into engineering things that are optimal. That not Mother Nature does not like things that are optimal. Mother Nature likes redundancy. And it likes two things. In the presence of high degree of connectivity, it likes things to be small so they don't, you know, impact others when they break. And the second thing, very simple, Mother Nature likes redundancy. It doesn't like things to be optimized. It applies to people in a room in India. I came, people in Lebanon, they're born with two lungs, a pair of eyes, two kidneys. I think it's the same in India, no? All right, okay. So it's the same in the States, I was told, and stuff like that. So if an economist were to design a human being, he would say 95% of lung capacity is unused on any given day, except when you have to run after a jet, airline, because they're going to take off without you. You don't use more than 5% of the lung capacity. Your kidneys, you don't need two kidneys. But guess what? Mother Nature doesn't think along the same lines. But actually, an economist, if he were to optimize a human being, he would not even give him two kidneys. So he puts one here in the center of the room, and we each borrow it when we need it. On a timeshare, much more efficient. All right? And you'd have your eyes, you'd rent them out at night, because it's not optimal to keep them, because you don't need them to dream. Okay? So here we have two paradigms. One of optimization, which seems to produce good numbers, okay, but at the same time makes you a lot more fragile. So with probability one, you're going to go bust, which is why companies go bust. They're driven by the stock market to the maximum fragility. Simple, okay. Like there's a company, I don't know, it's still around today, called Toyota.
Yeah, still around.
They optimize to the point of destruction, right? That's it. They try to shave every single penny to be more efficient and make more get good numbers. And so what happened to them? Okay, so now redundancy has an opposite. What's the opposite of redundancy? Debt. Instead of having two kidneys, I borrow a kidney, all right? Instead of having $100 capital, instead of putting 20 to use and having 80 hidden somewhere, I borrow 400, 500, or like Goldman Sachs, 33 times my capital, all right, and call myself conservative, all right, and optimal. Okay. So that is the opposite of redundancy. So here we have something happening in the world. If you want to see what's going on, is the best thing is that single graph. We were at the top in variations, and now we've moved to the bottom, where you can have extreme spikes. Complexity causes extreme spikes. Sudden extreme spikes. Numbers look better, but you're exposed to sudden extreme spikes. And at the same time, there was this elephant in the middle of the room nobody was noticing. Increasing fragility is that debt was rising dramatically. Since 1980, you see these numbers? That was from the 1920s. So debt rose, and then, of course, the Great Depression brought it down. And since 1980, debt has quadrupled. Debt in relation to GDP. 4 times. So we have a massive amount of debt in the Western world, about close to $100 trillion, too much in relation to what we had in 1980. And at the same time, you know what happened in 1980? Is a gentleman, Ronald Reagan, who was an actor of change, you know what he did, the internet. So we have a rise in complexity coupled with a rise of fragility. Surely this is going to happen. The most fragile thing was the banking system. So I kept saying to anybody who would listen to me, the banking system was going to go under. Nobody cared. They said, well, you know, great moderation gave me all these stories. And then in the end, they made a huge bet that the banking system was going to go bust. And it paid off. Now we're making another bet because what happened after the crisis, it looks like they didn't get that point. Obama still surrounded with people. Oh, he has a PhD from MIT. Okay, PhD from MIT, he doesn't know what he's talking about. He doesn't know we're an extremist man. All right? He didn't predict the crisis. But so all these people don't have the legitimacy they think they have. And giving advice on how to run what's going on. They don't realize, they didn't see the center of the problem. They're not going to see the center of the solution. The solution is break the back of the debt. That's it. We'll become more robust. That's the addition to the Black Swan, 100 pages, where I talk about robustification, a lot about biology, some about and finance, and of course, your own health and stuff like that, how you become robust, how things, systems are robust. That's sort of my idea on fragility and robustness. And the problem is, of course, we're not doing very well because even, you know, before the crisis, we had less debt than today. And today we're moving private debt to government debt. To show you how debt makes you fragile compared to equity, is when you have debt, debt maps one-to-one with overconfidence, with hubris. If you read the future very well, why issue equity? You borrow. You see, you're going to get a lot better return because you're not taking into account bad things that can happen to you. If you're more conservative, then you would issue equity. And the problem we know that debt destabilizes society, we've known that since the Babylonians, which is why Romans hated debt. Of course, the Arabs hated debt. Islam banned debt. Judaism banned debt. It banned debt, okay? And it had debt jubilees, also, like the Babylonians. And early Christianity hated debt. It's not till the Protestant Reformation that we started, you know, debt started getting a good name, even then, okay? It was for letters of credit. So debt fragilizes society. It maps one-to-one with hubris. And sure enough, we're still where we were before the crisis. Nobody's realizing what's going on. That's what I have to say so far. I'll continue, of course, using your questions as stepping stone, plus or minus, points. I'll use them in my conversation. Thank you very much. Thanks for listening to me.
Dilip, use a mic, please. How fragile do you think China is at this point of time? You said the big get fragile.
I have no idea yet about China. I mean, I don't know the structure. Sometimes, like France, for example, people think that France was a big nation state. France was completely dominated by small cities for a long time. And for the state to dominate France, it took till Giscard. It took 140 years of effort for the state to become a dominant thing. It was before run. So I don't know much about China. I know, and the example of France is, don't be fooled thinking that you have a big top-down state because it was totally, you know, powerless, right? So I don't know about China. I have no idea.
You predicted the current situation with the banks. Now, recently in America, the debt has increased maybe fourfold with the bailouts and all the freebies that are being given out. So what is your prediction, even though the debt to GDP ratio of America is not as bad as Europe, but still it affects the whole world, and what do you predict that may follow?
I see. No, I didn't really predict the crisis. I'm more like an engineer. I saw a bridge, and I said, this bridge is built for a 2-ton trucks, and we're going to have 20-ton trucks drive on it. So all you have to do is wait for it to collapse. The same situation holds today with a vicious element. We have debt, which is a mistake made between an adult, who turned out to be a fool, and a borrower who turned to another adult who turned also to be a fool. One underestimated his understanding of the other's abilities, the other misunderstood his own representation of the future and the complexity. Why is the state converting private debt into public debt? Because public debt is permanent and you're taxing your children. So America is immoral. I find governments should realize that it's so hard to predict that you should shoot for not a deficit, they shoot for mild deficits, they should shoot for a positive revenues, okay? Just like households, okay? Households, particularly if you don't have a rich father-in-law. And the world now with China, you know, sort of like not doing that great, doesn't have a father-in-law, rich father-in-law. So I don't know who's going to bail out except the printing press. So you're going to have Gutenberg bailing out everyone, all right? So you have here, the model is as follows. We are facing an environment with a huge amount of debt that's going to break, you know, the economy. Unemployment today is we have like 6 million more people unemployed than U.S. alone. And then you start having the domino effect. Governments are more reliant on projections today than they were before. So here we have Obama's budget, all right? Obama, by the way, made us spend all this money on stimulus, saying unemployment will be under 8%. What is it today? Okay. With Cook numbers, it's 10%, right? So let me tell you what problem we have today. We're relying more on these experts. So what's going to happen? Their next mistake is going to be to overprint. That's the only way out for them, which is why I fear hyperinflation. And I also think that the West is, the center of the world is moving away from the West, which, you know, towards Russia and of course, countries that don't have debt because they're either the culture was too slow and accommodating, right? I mean, take Dubai as an exception. And even a place like Dubai, they say Dubai has a lot of debt. Dubai is borrowing to put impressive buildings, you know, so they can put them on postcards, no? But America is borrowing to eat. you get the idea? So you see the trouble, all right? And Europe as well. Europe, Western Europe, I mean, Ireland is in deep trouble. So we have all that post-enlightenment, industrial revolution wave to me, is starting to fall apart towards a more conservative, robust model of less integration, less globalization, stuff like that. So what will happen next? I think government will make the usual mistake. They're going to overprint. They had no other choice. You know, you're going to have massive deflation, and they may make a mistake because of nonlinearity in economic policies. And then the other thing I'd like to warn is I was in Korea about 5 months ago, and I had my first access of rage in public. There was a gentleman from the IMF, number two from the IMF, who came and gave us his projections 2010, 11, 12, 13, 14. Okay? 15 he went, all right? He gave us numbers what I think the IMF will happen. I stopped immediately. I interrupted him to ask him, Sir, Mr. Kato, his name was, number two of the IMF, and okay, what was his projections for 2008 and 2009 made in 2003, 2004, 2005, 2006, 2007, all right? If you see that, you just realize that we have the people who got us here. Why? Because we rely, anytime someone produces these fake numbers, we rely on them, okay? So my point is not to stop people from being charlatans. My point is to build robustness to the errors of expert error. You see? That's my whole idea. And robustness has a very simple criteria. I wrote something in the Financial Times. It was the most downloaded article. called the Financial Times for the whole year, 2009, even now. It's called 10 Steps for Black Swan Robust Society. And that one, it starts with debt. It starts with the fact that government should not say, oh, we need to restore confidence. You can't control confidence. You might be robust. So very simple criteria of robustness. And it's, once you look at it that way, you realize you could lower 95% of the risks with two or three simple measures. Questions there?
Yeah. Can I just add to what the gentleman asked? How old is the turkey in the U.S.?
How what?
How old is the turkey in the U.S. which is being fed now?
How old is the turkey?
How old is it? Has it reached 1,001 days? Or how old?
Yeah, no,
is it?
I mean, this I don't know. I can't. I'm not in the business of like these forecasters. I'm in the business of detecting fragility. Okay? And you want to detect fragility. So saying, I'm not in the business of predicting when the bridge is going to collapse. I'm going to tell you this bridge is weak. All right? I'm a risk person. The banking system is still weak. And now we're transferring weakness to governments. The governments are weak now. It's just what happened to Greece. Greece has forecasted, by the way, 3% deficit. They have 13 officially, and you know, after the numbers really come out, maybe a lot more. The United States officially, all right, has a forecast close to that, and you know what's going to happen. They always underestimated their error rate. So I think that Turkey is government debt. I think the U.S. government debt. And they rely on the Chinese. The Chinese can buy, then suddenly, you know, they can't buy, all right?
Hi. My question is, you said about fragility. How fragile is the internet? And what would be an extremist on situation of the internet for us?
That's an excellent question, because I don't think anybody understands the internet. I was on a copy commission. Now I don't waste time. I spend time in my library, because I prefer it better used on my library, all right? But at some point, I was involved in something and studied the internet. I realized nobody understands it. You remember, there's one day Pakistan blocked YouTube, all right, in Pakistan. Okay, it led to general YouTube falling apart. And then there was also once an attack on a government website in the United States, and they shut down that node. It prevented them from being able to use the New Orleans, you know, the water control, all right? So the internet is way too, you know, you have a lot of fragilities that we don't see from network effects. I mean, supposedly, we have Nikesh will ask him if Google has its own passways, all right, redundant passways. They're sort of aware of it. They're not as foolish as people in finance and banking. But overall, do we quite understand the internet? I don't know. And I don't know, for example, let me give you an idea of why the world is more fragile from the internet. I was in Istanbul a year and a half ago, and I walked into my room, and the internet was not working. I called down the desk. They say, we'll connect you to IT. I spoke to a gentleman. He said, oh, you're room 1207. I think, yeah, let me fix it. Yeah, you should be up now. And then he was talking to me as if he were, you know, controlling my, you knew which room I was in. And then he had an Indian accent. I told him, are there many Indians in Istanbul? I was puzzled why I would have an Indian in Istanbul. He said, I'm not in Istanbul. All right? So he was here, somewhere here. So you realize the concentration that we don't, which works beautifully, it's more optimal, it's cheaper, everything's great, but you don't have redundant pathways. So the internet is, I don't know this fragility. All I know is that I make sure I print out anything I need to retrieve. Okay? Because, all right, because, you know, that's a potential. Yeah, there are two things I'm worried about more than finance. The internet, because of connectivity, and the other one is we're physically a lot more fragile. I started getting involved in physical robustness. Like, for example, you know, I'm in Delhi today. If I were in Delhi 100 years ago, I'd be sweating. So we're not exposed to thermal variation, so it makes you more fragile. You're not exposed to strain in your system. This is why you go to the health club. But even the health club, this is not ecological enough. So the lack is more weaker than our ancestors, believe it or not, okay? And so we'll be weaker. And then the other thing that's happening, we're a lot more connected. So what I said is the next super germ, the optimal one, would be the one with long incubation period. All right, doesn't kill its host immediately, will let it spread, will travel on Air France and Air India and perhaps Continental, maybe not British Air, but it's not, they're not not comfortable enough, but the other ones, you know. But so we'll travel, and that you see the idea. So there's two problems of connectivity we're facing today that will accentuate the next black swan, just like you have the super bestseller, thanks to the internet, called Harry Potter, okay, or the book on blackbirds that totally hard to read that people start buying thanks to the internet, that book Black Swan.
Black Swan.
Yeah. All right. So because of, you know, connectivity makes things fly like that, all right, the next germ will experience the same fate with hosts like us, a lot weaker, because we're technology makes us softer. So this is what I'm worried about, internet and but especially that super germ.
Okay, one last question and then we'll wrap up. Yeah, the gentleman here.
Dr. Talib, I wish there was an overlap with you and John Chambers, because we just had him before lunch and he had everybody spellbound with the promise of technology and the internet. And what two things he said was that they can see market transitions and they can plan 15 years. I just want to bring whatever you've said and make it a little relevant to India. You know, there's an economist, a famous Indian economist, who made a statement that we are like a passenger on a bicycle which goes past a BMW with a punctured tire, and we look at the driver and laugh at him because we are passing him by, not knowing that as soon as he repairs his puncture, he'll blow by us, you know, at 200 kilometers per hour. So when you talk about this problem in America and all the problems that have been there in history, these are happening at $40,000, $45,000 per capita income. For us, who are at $1,000, we would trade our position and have a banking crisis or many of these crises if we could get there. So is there some lesson?
No, there's something about, okay, let me talk about robustness again. Is India more robust than the United States? Vastly more. Okay. Okay, you have people in the United States with high GDP, but addicted to high level of debt, addicted to high level of spending, with an incompetent government. I mean, contradictory. My job as a logician is to detect. You have Geithner the same day tells the banks, you take too much risk, why don't you lend more? And tells the consumers, you know, you should spend more, you have too much debt, all right? I mean, there are a lot of logical inconsistencies. Incidentally, Geithner has two mortgages on his house, which means also inability to forecast variations in real estate prices. His house being 100 yards from mine, I almost bought it when it was on the market, but I said, no, I want to make him sweat, all right? So, it's smaller than mine. This is why I didn't buy it. But I said, okay, it's nice to go put my books or something. So just as a symbolic gesture. Anyway, so I'm saying that you have you have countries with a high level of GDP that are very fragile. Let me give you another example of why the United States is fragile, okay? A lot more fragile than, say, Soviet Union. Why London is more fragile than India, okay? I went through civil war in Lebanon, okay? When you go through civil war in Lebanon, you become obsessed with what happens when you have total breakdown of social order. And we had that. So I found a gentleman who knows the subject a lot more than me, Dmitry Orlov, who studied the breakdown of social order in the Soviet Union. And he said there was no breakdown of order. Why? They were not efficient. Agriculture in Russia or in the Soviet Union was inefficient. Stalin tried to make it efficient, and he couldn't. He had to kill all the farmers, right? And couldn't even make it efficient, okay? So you could not have, like in America, one center that makes all the oranges, one center that has the wheat, one place that has the apples, right? Or two places have the apples. So every city had around it enough agriculture to be self-sufficient. You had the same, all right? So in America, for every calorie you consume, you have 9 calories of energy, of transportation. In Russia, it's less than 1 calorie for every calorie consumed, okay? And now, this makes it very inefficient, but makes it very robust during the crisis. And also, lack of social mobility means you live in an apartment building with people who've known each other for 2 or 3 generations. So there's a built-up of trust, okay? You have that, people living in the provinces, except in a couple of big cities like Mumbai and Bangalore, okay? And so you have, in America, most people live in suburbs, very fuel inefficient, and most of the friends are on Facebook. So you realize you don't have, there are a lot of other elements that would prevent, that makes it a lot more fragile than the West, you see. And plus, with people in the West are so, have so much debt. So GDP is meaningless, okay? You want an indicator of robustness. Okay, all these governments, they shot for GDP. It's meaningless, totally meaningless, absolutely meaningless. Doesn't even reflect standards of living. You can have three times the GDP and live worse off. I mean, in Amun, they have a low GDP and they live vastly better than in America. All right, Amun is my village in Lebanon where I'm progressively residing, you see. You get that. So, to answer your question, there's another element, the curse that comes with high GDP, is that people can contract spending now they can contract spending a lot, all right, without lowering the standard of living, but hurting the standard of living of someone else by having fewer other, people employed. So in other words, you don't need to buy a new car, or you don't need to buy a new flat screen TV. But by not buying that, you can contract this expenditure. You're hurting yourself indirectly. You have feedback loops because you're not going to buy a flat screen TV made in China, so the Chinese won't buy the treasury bonds. You see the idea. So this is why I think we're trapped now with the highest unemployment we're going to see, and it's going to keep going.
Thank you, Dr. Taleb. I will close the session now, and he's here with us during dinner and later in the evening. I'm sure you guys will get an opportunity to chat with him, interact with him. May I invite you all to generously applaud this very unusual presentation by him.